think there's so much interest in the book of Revelation? Why is there the interest? Hard to understand. Why do you think it's hard to understand? Signs and symbols. Okay? Figurative. It's a book that is not written like normal books are written. So as a result of that, it's a little bit different. It's hard for us when we first start. Now, I'm going to tell you something, and you may laugh at me now, but when we finish this course, I hope this is what you'll think. That's not hard at all. I used to think the book of Revelation was a very difficult book. When I went to college, I had a college class on Revelation. And my college professor used various commentaries, and his approach was, we really don't know what Revelation says. I'm going to give you three or four different options, and you can choose whichever one you want to follow. I got to thinking about that, and that did not leave me very satisfied. That's sort of like saying, okay, you take a book of the Bible, and you just read through it, and whatever you want it to say, you let it say that. That does not make sense to me. God is not the author of confusion, 1 Corinthians chapter 14. That means he did not write a confusing book. And you say, oh yes he did, because I've read it before. Well, the problem is, most of us start the book of Revelation by reading the end of the book of Revelation, and we sort of let it be a standalone book. And we sit down and we read it, and it doesn't make sense because we haven't heard this before. Okay, next thing I'm going to tell you. Almost everything in the book of Revelation is found elsewhere in the Bible. Almost everything. It is in the Old Testament, and it is in the words of Jesus. Now, the problem is the Old Testament part comes from those sections, other than the cute stories, from those sections of the prophets that we don't read very much. In fact, some people never read at all. And if you don't understand the Old Testament prophets, you're not going to understand the book of Revelation. If you don't understand what Jesus said about the end of the world when he gave what is called the Olivet Address, you won't understand the book of Revelation either, because it's all in there. Okay, I'm going to give you an assignment for next week. So I would like for you to put down and write down, and I didn't put this on, so this is not on the notes that I'm going to hand out later. But I want you to do some reading for next week. I want you to stay primarily in the book of Matthew, and I want you to read these particular references. Matthew chapter 21, verses 18 through 22. Matthew 21, verses 18 through 22. Matthew 21, verses 38 through 45. Matthew 21, verses 38 through 45. Matthew 22, verses 1 through 14. Matthew 22, 1 through 14, then Matthew 23 and 24, all of it. Okay, now we're going to talk about that next week as it relates to Revelation, because it really does relate to Revelation. So I need you to read that in advance, and then we'll talk about it. If you would like, there are parallel scriptures in Mark 13 and in Luke 21. And you can look at those because they are very similar. They're a little different, but they're also very similar. So, with that in mind, I am ready for us to begin talking about the book of Revelation. Now, I'm going to ask you a question, and you don't have to answer because I'll answer it for you in a minute. What do you think the book of Revelation is about? 90% of you are going to say the end of the world. Okay? I mean, that's what this book is taught as in most places. It really is not talking about the end of the world. And we will take time to go through the scriptures and look at it. When I was so frustrated and confused about the book of Revelation, having had that class in college where they basically said, read it and come up with your own meaning, and any meaning is as good as another, I just decided to leave it alone until at Mars Hill, they said, we need you to teach a Bible class on Revelation. And I thought, oh no, not that. That's the one thing I don't want to teach. But after getting into it, it's the one thing I absolutely love now. I mean, I really love this book. I love the book because I teach Christian evidences, apologetics, reasons why we believe what we believe. The book of Revelation is one of the greatest books of apologetics that you can find. Because as you finish this, and when you see what it's saying, you'll say, wow, God knew everything. He said this was going to happen. It happened. He even used symbols that are perfect symbols for this particular concept. And so as a result of that, then I began to look into it. And here's my philosophy on teaching the book of Revelation. Number one, let the Bible interpret itself. You don't have to go outside the Bible. It's okay to look at history. And I think history is fine. But you really don't have to go anywhere else except the Bible. Because what you'll find is Revelation is based on everything that has come previous to the book of Revelation. So it's the last of the books. It's not a standalone book. It's a book that you read after you've read everything else. Let the Bible interpret itself. Secondly, God is not the author of confusion. God does not use a symbol in one place and change the meaning in some other place without telling you he's going to do it. So as you look through this book, you're going to find the symbols are consistent. You don't change them. With that in mind, let's just take a moment and think about how the book has been misused throughout history. Almost everybody, in at least since the 1800s, have used this book as evidence that the end of the world is about to happen. And it starts back in the time of a man named William Miller. Any of you know who William Miller was? Anybody? What religion was he affiliated with? Okay, they were called the Millerites, ultimately. But if you look back, it's the Seventh-day Adventist group. And also, he had an impact on the Jehovah's Witnesses. And he believed that he could predict the end of the world based on the book of Revelation and the signs which he said were in there. Now you see, here's where we go. We say the book of Revelation, talking about the end of the world, it contains all these signs. Okay, they said those signs were talking about 1830s. They said those signs were talking about the 1860s. They said those signs were talking about the 1880s. Those signs were talking about the 1900s. Those signs were talking about the year 2000. And every time they had to back up and start all over again. And the reason is they're not talking about signs for the end of the world. You know what Jesus said would happen in regard to the end of the world and signs? What did he say? Of that day and hour, no one knows. And he said, I don't even know. So if he doesn't know, he's not about to give us signs that talk about the end of the world when he says, I don't know when it's coming. Only God the Father knows. Now then, if he tells you there are no signs for the end of the world, which he plainly does, one man will be in the field, another one will be sleeping, it'll be like a thief in the night, then the book of Revelation, which is filled with signs, can't possibly talk about the end of the world because that would contradict what Jesus plainly said. And so when you start letting the Bible interpret itself, it becomes clearer and clearer and clearer. And honestly, by the time you get through, I think you will have a really good understanding of the book of Revelation. Let's talk about the definition. Well, I don't need to go through any more of these end of the world things, do I? Y'all know that people have talked about this and done this. Edgar Wisenant, who was an engineer in Nashville, wrote 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Occur in 1988. And, this sort of funny. But Nancy and I had friends in Nashville who fell for it. And they believed it was going to happen, and the Bible taught it. And then when it didn't happen, it shattered their faith. Because after all, the Bible said it was going to take place, and then it didn't take place, so the Bible must be wrong. And of course, Harold Camping came out in 2011. You remember he put the signs all over the buses and everywhere else saying the same thing. I love this definition of Revelation. It comes based on my background as a teacher of American literature, Ambrose Bierce. He wrote what was called the Devil's Dictionary. Here is his definition of the book of Revelation. Revelation, a famous book in which St. John the Divine concealed all that he knew. The revealing is done by commentators who know nothing. Well put. Because that's pretty much where we are. What is the term at the beginning of the book? At the top of that page? What do you see? What does it say? Not the text. What's the title? What does it say? It says, The Revelation. Do any of you have anything else? Revelation of St. John the Divine or something? Anybody of you have one of the older versions that says the Apocalypse of St. John? That used to be the term that was used, Apocalypse. That's the closer of the Greek words. Comes from the Greek word apokalypsis. You know what it means? To reveal. That's why it's called revelation. Revelation. Apokalypsis means a revealing. It's not a concealing. And as I was going through these classes in college, they were saying, oh, John was writing this way so that he conceal and hide everything so that the Romans wouldn't know what was going on. That's not what this book means. It's revealing, not concealing. Very beginning of it opens that way. The revelation that God gave to John, or actually to Jesus, who then turned it over to John. Okay, so it's important that you have that background and you understand this book is written to be understood. Look at verse 3 of chapter 1. Verse 3 of chapter 1. Okay, what does it say?
Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near.
Okay, let's just take the first part tonight. Blessed is, can I put in the word everyone? Isn't that what it's saying? Am I correct, yes or no?
Yes.
Blessed is everyone who reads this book. So somebody who's reading this in the 21st century, like we are we blessed by reading it?
Yes.
How about somebody in the 10th century? How about somebody in the 1st? You know what that means? This book had to be understood in the 1st century. And the 10th, and the 21st. All of that time period, it's got to be understandable to every age. And then we have people that come through and read it and bless their hearts. They say the scorpions are Apache helicopters. And they will tell you that all of this is talking about a nuclear war at the end of the world. How could somebody in the first century have read and understood that? It is totally impossible. So it can't be talking about that because the blessings go to people of all times and in all places. Okay, to whom is the book written? Please tell me. It's there. It is written in verse 4 to the seven churches of Asia. Okay? Existed when? Okay, what are the seven churches? Starting out, Ephesus, Pergamum. Okay, you can all the way through Laodicea, seven of them. Did they exist in the first century?
They're present day churches.
Do they exist today? Now, knowing that, people in the first century, it's written to them primarily. So, as they read this, they can gain firsthand experiences because they know these. Can we use the same information they had and gain information from what they knew? Sure we can. But it's written to first century churches. If it's written to first century churches, it's not talking about the end of the world. Unless the end of the world was coming in the first century. And you know there were a lot of people that believed it was. And we'll talk about that in a later lesson. But now then, it is written to people, first century churches. And look over in chapter 13 real quick and in verse 8. Because I know I'm jumping ahead here. Or verse 18, not verse 8. I just want you to see what it says. Chapter 13, verse 18. It's one of those symbols. What does it say? What does the verse say?
This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, which is for man's number. This number is 666.
Okay, one of those strange symbols in the book of Revelation. But he says, if anyone has wisdom, no time limit here, written the first century. He says people in the first century can calculate the number of the beast. Folks, if people in the first century can calculate the number of the beast, it's not Obama. It is not Putin. It is not Muhammad. If people in the first century could calculate it, it had to be somebody living then. And he says they can do it. And by the way, you'll find this scattered throughout the entire version. Okay. With that in mind, God is trying to communicate a message to us, and here is some numbers, and this is all written down for you, so you don't have to write this down. How many chapters in the book of Revelation? You can see that real quickly. Just turn to the last one. 22. There are a minimum of 348 references to the Old Testament in those 22 chapters. That's about 15 references per chapter. What does that tell you? It's deeply rooted in the Old Testament. All right, now, which of the prophets are spoken of mostly? It's mostly Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah. Now, again, most of you know the story at the outset of Isaiah. How many of you have read chapters 55 through 66 in detail? Huh. You know it talks about a new heaven and a new earth? You know it talks about a lot of the other things that Revelation talks about? Book of Ezekiel. You know the story probably of some of the strange things about the prophet Ezekiel. But did you know it talks about the sealing of people, and Revelation talks about sealing people? It talks about the tree of life in Ezekiel. It talks about the tree of life in Revelation. All I'm telling you is, if you understand what it was talking about originally, you got a heads up on all of these other folks who don't have a clue. Because God is drawing from the Old Testament to do that. Now, he also draws a huge amount from what Jesus said in that lesson that he gave on the Mount of Olives. Background is this, and there's some things that lead up to it. But in the middle of it, Jesus has been in the temple. It's the last week that he has on earth. He has been preaching in the temple. And as he's preaching in the temple, the Jews finally have just annoyed him to the point that he, in chapter 23, he unleashes a broadside against the unbelieving Jews. I mean a broadside. He calls them hypocrites, and he calls them snakes, and he says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees." And then, after having said that, he turns around and he marches out. Now, evidently, the apostles weren't with him. Because then the next chapter opens that the apostles come to him and they say to him, "Don't you see all of these wonderful buildings of the temple here?" Most of you need to take a little time to think about what they really saw. That was the backbone of their religion. The temple was awesome. It was almost considered one of the wonders of the ancient world. In fact, the earlier references, the travel guides that were made up that had the seven wonders, were almost all written in the 2nd and 3rd centuries B.C. by some of those early Greek and Roman writers. People who wrote the later guides almost always included the temple up until 70 A.D. when it was destroyed. It was a fabulous place. The stones were as large as any found anywhere, those foundation stones. Picture, if you will, one stone the size of a boxcar. Solid. It is the largest stone ever found in any building, anywhere. Pyramids don't even come close. This stone was 600 tons. Pyramid doesn't have anything larger than 70. The largest of the pyramids. I mean, this was awesome. Okay, so the disciples say, don't you see all these things? And Jesus said to them, listen, let me tell you. Do you see these things? Let me assure you, not one stone is going to left be on top of another that will not be thrown down. And that was just like a slap in the face to the apostles. Because that was the key to their religion. It was their pride. And so Jesus leads them out through the Kidron Valley up onto the Mount of Olives. You can just picture, oh, what's he talking about? What in the world was he meaning? Surely he didn't mean that. See, they thought he was going to come back and establish a kingdom on earth, and that meant that temple was going to be the center focus of it. Now he's saying they're going to destroy it. So get up on the other side of the mountain, and they stop Jesus, and they say, what are you talking about? And Jesus then begins to answer their questions, and that's what you're going to be reading for next week. So now then, I want you to understand what Jesus said. I want you to understand what the Old Testament prophets said. And as we do that, we can start going through the book of Revelation, and we're going to find out, wow, that makes sense. That's exactly what he was talking about. All right. The next thing that I would like for you to know is, and by the way, somebody, what time is it? How close are we being through? So,
it's right at 7.
What?
It's right at 7.
All right. Okay. Open your Bibles to Revelation chapter 1. Got time for this. I was hoping I would. I don't like trying to explain away what the Bible says. Okay? When it says something, I really want to believe that's what it means. So here we go into Revelation chapter 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must soon or shortly take place. Now, you can go back and you can find that early Christians believed very strongly that Jesus was coming back in the first century. That's pretty obvious when you read the books of the New Testament. So we'll get back to that. But this is what he says. Look at verse 3. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it. So people in the first century could keep them. For the time at hand, near. You realize that's the second time in the first three verses it said that? You think just maybe God's trying to get our attention on this? Because he is telling this over and over again. And you will find that this is not one time or two times. It happens several times, not only in the opening chapters, but a couple of times throughout the book and then several times at the end as well. All right, verse 19. John is told, write the things which you have seen, the things which are, and the things which will take place after this. So Revelation is divided into three parts, things that have already happened, things that are happening right as they're being written about, and then things that are going to be in the future. So just sort of file that away. Let's go over to chapter 22. 21 and 22. Chapter 22, verse 6. He said to me, these words are faithful and true. The Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show his servants what? Things which must soon or shortly take place. Verse 10. He said to me, do not seal the words of the prophecy of this book. Why? Because the time is near. Okay. He is certainly trying to get our attention because he says that at the opening and he says that at the end and he says it multiple times. And in verse 20, he who testifies to these things says, behold, I come. Now, at this point, folks, let's just be honest. Are you going to take it as its word? Or are you going to explain it away? Now, if you explain it away, here's how it's usually explained away. Well, this was talking about something out in the future, and when it does happen, it will happen quickly. Not what it said. Not at all. But now, what does that mean in regard to the coming of Jesus? You know, the Bible tells you a lot about that too, and most of the time we ignore it. We'll talk about it, not tonight, but we're going to talk about that too. And we're going to see that this book is accurate. And I think as you go through it and you get that sort of background, it'll be even more and more obvious. Okay, I want to talk about something else here. Look at verse 10 again. He said to me, "Do not seal the words of the prophecy of this book." What does it mean to seal the words of the prophecy? Okay, don't allow it to be kept a secret. Don't seal it. I want you to look at something else. Daniel chapter 8. Remember, I told you we're going to be bouncing all through Scripture here. But in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 26, Daniel is given some instructions. He's just been shown some things that are taking place. And he says, "The vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true. Therefore," what? 8:26, Daniel 8:26. "Therefore," what? You are to do what, Daniel? Seal it up. Why? Because it says it refers to many days in the future. So you seal it up because it's a long way off. Now, scholars will tell you that the events that are described here in chapters 8 and 9 are talking about the time of Jesus. So it's about 500 years in the future. And so God says to Daniel, you seal this up, it's a long way off, it's 500 years away. And then you come to Revelation 22 and 10, and it says, don't seal it up because the time is at hand. Could you see anything that's more of a contrast? I mean, it's pretty obvious that Daniel was told 500 years is so far in the future, you can just seal it up. Whereas John has said, don't you seal this up, it's time for these things to happen. We are now 20 centuries away from things that happened in that first century. That's four times the amount of time that Daniel was allowed. And God told Daniel to seal it up. So again, as you look at that, you have to let the Bible sort of interpret itself. And God is trying to get all of that into our background. There's one other thing that I want you to notice. I thought that was a...
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was thinking that was a fire alarm. Maybe I'm getting too fiery in here. It is hot in here. I'm sorry. One of the things that I want you to notice, too, in the book of Revelation is their reference to the earth or the land. And this happens over and over again. It talks about these are the things. For example, verse 7, the tribes of the earth. Verse 5, the kings of the earth.
First chapter.
Okay, I'm sorry. First chapter. It is talking about the earth. And it does this all the way through. It talks about the plagues descending on the earth, for example. Okay, fine. Let's be sure we understand the context here. The Greek word is ge, G-E. We get our word Gaia, earth, from that. You know, if you study science, you know that Gaia is that part of the earth which was all together at the beginning of time, which is consistent with what the Bible teaches too. So, but anyway, it's talking about land or the earth. But remember, earth and land are almost the same. They're almost identical. And the word gay, G-E, is translated equally by both terms. Sometimes it's translated land, sometimes it's translated earth. It depends on the context. Here's the amazing thing. If you go through the Bible, you'll find that the majority of the time, and I'm going to give you numbers here, you don't have to write them down, you've got all this coming, 1,700 times to 600 times, the more common interpretation is land, not earth, in the sense of a circular globe, but land. The Jews referred to Palestine as the land. And everything else was called not the land. See, they were very sold on this promised land. It was a physical area. And their priest called it the land. Now then, when you come into the book of Revelation, it is fascinating to me to see that this term is almost always translated earth in the Revelation as opposed to land. And that's very different from everything else we find in Scripture. So, is it talking about a circular globe, or is it talking about the land of Palestine? As is usually the case, you have to let the context tell you. And when you notice, it says we are talking here about the tribes of the land, or tribes of the earth. Every time you hear word tribes in the Bible, what is it talking about?
12 tribes.
Israel was organized into tribes. Other peoples were not. So when it talks about the tribes, it's talking about Israel. So the tribes of the land. Now, with that in mind, look at again at chapter 1, verse 7. This is basically the theme of the book of Revelation. You can say this just summarizes the whole book. He is coming with clouds. Every eye will see him, even they who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him. All of the tribes of the earth. That is talking about Israel. Who was responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus? The leaders of the Jewish people. You can read all the way through the New Testament. Over and over again, Paul and Peter and John and James and Jude, and they're going to tell you that it was their own people that was responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus. And they say it over and over again. This is not something that is to be used in an anti-Semitic way. Okay? There were a lot of Jews who were Christians. It's not against a people, it's against the leaders of the Jews at that time who were in rebellion against God. And the tribes of the earth will see Jesus coming back. He will come in the clouds. Now, again, if you take time and you go back and you look at the phrase, comes in clouds, I want you to know something. In Old Testament times, this happened several times. It said God was coming in the clouds. It said God was coming in the clouds against Egypt. It said God was coming in the clouds against Assyria. It said God was coming in the clouds against Edom. Now, my question to you is, did God physically ever come in literal clouds in any of those? Not that we know of. Let's be honest, not that we know of. Yet, it is exactly the same terminology. It is saying Jesus is coming in the clouds. That is, he's coming with power, and he is going to do something to those who pierced him. Okay, now this sets the stage because he is talking about the land of Israel. And the Romans in 70 AD obliterated the Jewish people and the land of Israel. And that's what most of the book of Revelation is talking about. So if you start in chapter 1 and you go through chapter 11, that's the focus. It doesn't go anywhere else. At the end of that, God tells John, you're going to have to prophesy again. And this time, it's going to be in regard to many nations and peoples and tribes and tongues. So, when you come to chapter 13, through the rest of the book, you can now start incorporating the Roman Empire. Because that's obviously being dealt with in the last part of the book. So, that's your overview, okay? Chapters 1 through 11, Israel. Chapters 13 and following, Israel and Rome. And that's as far as it goes. Okay, now then when you come to the last part of the book, you deal with the 1,000 years, you deal with Armageddon, you deal with the new heavens and the new earth. And we'll talk about that when we get to that. But I want us to get through that first part and finish. Okay, what questions do you have? I have flown through this. You're bound to have some. It's okay to ask. Nobody?
Oh, it's okay. You gave them the Matthew reading, but he said Mark 13 and Luke.
21.
Thank you.
And basically, they're just different versions of the Sermon on the Mount of Olives. Little bit of difference given. Luke, for example, tells us some information that the others don't that helps us to understand what Matthew was talking about, for example. Okay. All right. I have persecuted you enough for one night.